You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 53. The last show was all about Preservation Hall in New Orleans. In that one, I sat down with Ben Jaffe. Ben is the band leader of the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. We talked about his parents who founded Preservation Hall back in 1961, and we also talked about blending the past with new sounds, collaborations with people like Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters. We also talked about the work of the Preservation Hall Foundation and all the things they do to teach kids about music and education. We did that and a whole lot more. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. It was our 52nd show, which marks 2 years of episodes. I enjoyed the discussion with Ben, and I think you'll love it too. On today's episode, I get to share a discussion I had recently with noted New Orleans author and geographer Richard Campanella. We talk about his book Bienville's Dilemma as a prelude to the 300th anniversary of the founding of New Orleans in 1718. Throughout 2018, the city of New Orleans is going to be celebrating the tricentennial, so I thought a discussion about the founding of the city would be a good way to end 2017 on the show. This is the third appearance on the podcast by Richard. In episode 36, we talked about how Bourbon Street happened, and on number 40, we talked about Abraham Lincoln's visits to New Orleans. In today's show, you're going to learn about why Bienville chose this spot on the Mississippi to found New Orleans. You'll hear about the various dilemmas that have confronted the city's residents over time, and one of my favorite parts of the discussion was when Richard talks about how you can find traces of the past based on the way the city's streets are laid out. You'll never wander through Uptown New Orleans again without noticing a few things after listening. But before we jump in, first a word from our sponsor, me. As you know, the podcast is all about helping you explore New Orleans like an insider. If you're planning a trip to New Orleans and you want to cut through all the research, we're here to help. We offer a personalized travel consult, and here's how it works. First, you complete a brief questionnaire to help us get to know you and the experience you want to have in New Orleans. It includes things like your interests, your budget, and the dates of your visit. Next, we set up a 20 to 30 minute phone call or a video call, and during that talk, we get to know each other a little better. We can clarify any questions and bounce a few ideas off of you to make sure we're on the right track. After that discussion, we prepare and deliver a PDF document with our recommendations for your trip. Depending on your needs, the report will contain specific places to stay, eat, and drink. We'll also offer suggestions on things to do and see, all based on your budget and your interests. Sounds good? Just go on over to beyondbourbonst.com/travel for all the details and a link to order the service. Now, let's jump into the discussion with Richard. Hey, Richard, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I was really excited to come back. And Richard, for those of you that may be new listeners, this is our third time together. We talked about how Bourbon Street was formed, and how Bourbon Street happened, I should say. And we talked about Lincoln and his flatboat journeys down to New Orleans in the 1828, 1830.
1831, both of which have books affiliated with them.
That's right. And we will certainly, I'll mention this throughout. I appreciate you reminding me, but you can find all the information about Richard's 8 books and his numerous
10.
Other 10 books now, excuse me, at richcampanella.com. And you can follow Rich on Twitter, at Nola Campanella. And we'll put all the links to that over in the show notes. Today's episode 53. So you'll find all that at beyondbourbonst.com/53. But what I wanted to, the reason we're visiting with Richard today is that we're about to celebrate the 300th birthday, if you will, of New Orleans. And Richard wrote a book nearly 10 years ago now called Bienville's Dilemma. And I thought it was a great framework to, an excuse, if you will, to have you back, but really a great framework for our listeners, Richard, about that moment in time and sort of before and after this important anniversary we're going to celebrate. So maybe if we could just start with, nominally, what does Bienville's Dilemma mean? How did you come to that?
Bienville's Dilemma is, when I kind of framed that, what I was specifically referring to was not so much Bienville's difficult decision, but rather the one of the French colonials 300 years ago, of which he had a very specific solution. And so Bienville's dilemma is this: should a city be located at the safest site despite its inconvenience, or should it be located at the most strategic geographical situation despite its risk? To translate that to the decision that Bienville made, even as other French colonials were making similar decisions elsewhere in the Gulf Coast and lower Mississippi, should New Orleans be placed such that it had the best access for ships coming in from the Gulf of Mexico and the rest of the Atlantic system, as well as rafts and commodities coming down the Mississippi Basin in the opposite direction? Should it be close to the mouth of the river, or is that too risky? Should it be farther up to be on higher ground, or would that make it even less convenient to ocean-going ships? Should it be in Biloxi and Mobile? Should it be in Natchez and Natchitoches? And when I say it, I'm referring to both the capital of the Louisiana colony as well as the headquarters of the Company of the West. And there were partisans in each of those locations vying to get the capital and the headquarters in their location because it would bring new value to their land grants there, et cetera. And so the dilemma is, at a more metaphorical level, is the one we live with to this day. Should we relocate to higher ground? What do we do in the face of eroding coasts, sinking soils, and rising seas? And so there is resonance and parallels between the decisions made between humans looking out over their natural environment 300 years ago and comparable situations to today in lower Louisiana.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating as I was reading the book. And again, the book was published in 2008. So for context, just a couple years after Katrina, really sort of the early days after Katrina, when you think about that. And it really struck me as I read the book that this was in many ways, it was the exact same discussions that Bienville and his mates were having back then, and the same consternations about the pros and cons. And then I set that against today. We're in an early December day. It's raining. It's cold here. And that same thing couldn't help. I noticed it coming in that, again, you got water falling, and our relationship with water here is so central to that decision. But I think it's fascinating what you said, that it wasn't an easy decision. We may think of it today that, gosh, strategically it makes sense. We're right up against the river. But back then there was a lot of consternation and arguments, pros and cons, about the river versus an inland area or further up the river. Is that right?
Right. There were the range of options. I would almost describe Bienville's sighting of New Orleans as the least lousy of a range of site options within an absolutely fantastic geographical situation. And as a geographer, I distinguish between site and situation. Site is the literal physical footing of a city, a community, an outpost. Situation is how it interconnects with the rest of the world. So to give you an example, Manhattan's site is this bedrock island. Its situation is this incredible, wide, deep draft harbor with direct access to Europe. And so ships coming right in had that safe port there, deep harbor. And so New York had a great site and a great situation. Thus, no surprise that it's the largest city in the nation. Then you have places, we have probably thousands of places that may or may not have great sites, but have lousy geographical situations. You know what we call them? Small towns. Then we have New Orleans, which is almost in this kind of Shakespearean place where it has an incredibly fantastic situation. The one place that would connect the entire global maritime system with what proved to be the richest valley on Earth. So even as it needs to exist situationally, no truly safe site is available. And so we had to make do with the least lousy of them.
Well, a couple of things about that. And you, again, you go into great detail in the book, Bienville's Dilemma. But the site that Bienville came upon was not an unsettled site.
Correct.
There were inhabitants here.
Oh, yes, very much. This was a highly humanized environment. Indigenous groups occupied the Deltaic Plain for essentially the same reasons that attracted Europeans here. Rich, productive ecologies here, ranging from agricultural opportunities on the fertile soil of the natural levee. And they formed semi-permanent settlements with built environments and croplands, corn, millet. They had temples. They had settled communities. But what was also here, and the greater New Orleans area was kind of almost kind of a dividing line between those agricultural communities along the river to these coastal, on one side, and on the other side, these coastal midden communities that were more seasonal and conditional, that lived out in the saline marshes and subsisted off proteins, finfish, shellfish, those little rangia clams, mussels, oysters, game. And so New Orleans was kind of at the nexus of those two indigenous economies. At the same time, it was also to the north of the river was one linguistic group and a completely different one. The Chitimacha linguistic group was the south of the river. And populations were high here until the first Spanish arrivals, which are in the second quarter of the 16th century, the 1500s, two expeditions in the 1520s, and then De Soto in the 1540s. And unbeknownst to them, what they did, of course, was introduce European diseases, which occasioned a massive demographic die-off, such that by the time the French did arrive here, they encountered many indigenous, but also what struck them as the forest primeval, an empty wilderness.
Right.
And it was really kind of a misinterpretation that has lasted into modern times, that indigenous populations throughout the Americas were low. And in fact, now we know that they were much larger than we had previously assumed.
Right. And again, in the book, you talk about not only in what we think of as New Orleans proper, but, and it makes sense, up the river as you move up. There were different groups, but there were groups there. It was fairly.
Right.
It was settled. There was a community.
Oh, yeah.
There were
the
trading.
The Natchez, the Tunica. They travel far and wide. In terms of the exact tribes, it's amazingly complicated.
Sure.
And of course, much of what we know about them comes from the very agents of their demise. It was recorded, you know, through the colonial gaze, and written down in ways that may or may not have concurred with how Native Americans would have contested, have described themselves. There are also tribes that conflated together and moved around. So the Biloxi would come in and out, the Houma, there were the Tunica, the Chitimacha, the Natchez. You know, when the French arrived here, it was those tribes, even though their numbers were reduced, who called the shots here.
Right.
They knew the terrain. They had much greater numbers. And so many of the early interactions were one of French deference, trying to find the right allies of who to team up with.
Well, and you talk about in the book again that, you know, key to New Orleans, and maybe people not from here don't realize that coming up the mouth of the river is one way to get to the site that's now New Orleans, but it's not the easiest by any means. The easiest is to come through what is now known as the Rigolets and Lake
right.
Pontchartrain and Bayou St. John.
Right.
And the Indians were critical in showing the French and others how to get from what is now the French Quarter up the Portage Bayou Road now and up the ridge of Esplanade to get to Bayou St. John.
That's exactly right. And there's one moment where Bienville, in his various letters and memoirs, and Bienville tended to be a man of few words. He was taciturn. He was humorless. But there was one moment that, and I'll paraphrase it, where he marveled at how the Indians made maps for us in the dust. And I could just picture, you know, with his foot kind of illustrating. And it was that portage that Bienville probably first came across back in 1699 when he and his older brother Iberville were first exploring around here. But 19 years later, he used that to do the exact sighting of New Orleans. And so this is, as you said, coming from Biloxi and Mobile through the Mississippi Sound, taking those longshore currents through the Wrigley's, through the protected waters of Lake Pontchartrain, up that twisted bayou known as St. John. You disembark at a very slight ridge, roughly where Moss Street meets Bell and DeSoto and Grand Route St. John. And then you walk a two-mile portage just slightly on a ridge, slightly above the swamps, that gets you to the Mississippi without going up the Mississippi. And it circumvents all of those shoals and sandbars that flummoxed activity at the mouth of the river.
So for visitors to New Orleans that come for Jazz Fest, it strikes me that if you walk out of Jazz Fest and you choose to wander back to the French Quarter down Esplanade, you're not that far off that path.
Oh, I could give you, when you come out of Jazz Fest on Gentilly Boulevard, you are already on a ridge system that connects with the Bayou Road Ridge. And so just follow that toward the river. When you cross Broad, Gentilly Boulevard becomes Bayou Road. Mm-hmm. Follow that. You'll cut across Esplanade at kind of an odd, acute angle. And then just follow Bayou Road. The name changes to Governor Nichols. It goes through Treme. And before you know it, you cross Rampart and you're in the French Quarter. But notice, as you cross Rampart, Governor Nichols does not quite line up perfectly on the Treme side with the Governor Nichols on the French Quarter side. And the reason is the French Quarter was laid out by engineers. The other side was laid out by nature. And so you'll see just a slight jog in Governor Nichols as it crosses Rampart.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that a little bit later because you do – there's one of the articles in your book goes into some detail about that. I thought it was fascinating. But one of the other things you just mentioned about the ridges, I, as a native New Orleanian, sort of accept and have said many times, you know, we all live below sea level. But one of the fascinating things to me in your book is that for much of New Orleans' existence, that wasn't the case. And even today, in many places, it isn't the case. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
One of my specialty topics. The good news is the greater New Orleans metropolitan area south of the lake is 50% above sea level. The bad news is it used to be 100% above sea level. The river created the deltaic plain above sea level. If there were any substantially sized areas that were below sea level, they would have filled with water. And we wouldn't think of them as components of the terrestrial surface. We would call them bays or lakes or bayous. So what happened? Just give a profile of the topography here. The river built the delta, and it did so with greatest intensity closest to the river. And so the areas paralleling the Mississippi, its distributaries, and where those distributaries used to flow are the highest. So along Chapatula Street, you're 10 to 12 feet above sea level. You go back to Magazine and St. Charles, you're down to about 6 to 4 feet above sea level. These are current measurements.
Sure.
And then historically, when you went back from there, you would have gone to a few inches above sea level in places like the lake sides of Lakeview and Gentilly and Metairie. And then right along Lake Pontchartrain, which is a bay, it's a brackish water bay, you would be in saline marshes, but still necessarily above the level of the sea, which is the level of the lake. What changed this was in part the levees along the Mississippi River, but mostly the artificial drainage system, the sewage and water board, the pumping system we all know and love and hate today, starting about in the 1890s. And so what that did was remove the runoff and they reduced the groundwater, which in turn allowed for the development of wonderful neighborhoods like Lakeview and Gentilly and Metairie and Eastern New Orleans. But what it also did was remove the water component from the soil body, creating air pockets and cavities into which very fine sand, silt, and clay particles settled, compacted, and dropped below sea level. So it was the successful attempt to drain and dry out New Orleans that ended up sinking half of it below sea level.
Well, and it struck me in the book again, the book is titled Bienville's Dilemma, but that's a sort of all of humankind dilemma. And certainly those decisions that you just describe have been dilemmas for Louisianians and for New Orleanians since our birth. that it's always that. You can control one piece of almost always the river, but it has unintended consequences that we seem to be very good at not forecasting or not accepting, not thinking about. I was also struck in your book, and again, I would encourage everyone to read it because you go into so much detail about all of these topics and more, but the idea that what we think of as New Orleans today and really Louisiana is relatively new land. And you go into a lot of detail about the forces and the pressures and the currents and how the feeder rivers create where we are now. But all of that friction and motion and the deposits of the different soil types that you talk about, it all resulted in this, on the one hand, really prime agricultural opportunity, but also this, not all of it was meant to be inhabited. So we start to change it and those effects that you talk about. You went into a fascinating discussion. There was an article called Ooze, or about ooze.
The topography of ooze.
And I just thought it kind of gets, if you could talk a little bit about what you just said about the deltas created, it allows things to, different types of sediment to back up, and then we decide to build on that.
Well, the way I characterize it is, this environment we have here, the way the Mississippi River originally built it, this is a fluvial delta. Which is no ordinary. I mean, deltas are not that common to begin with. The type we have here is all that more scarce, and it's called a fluvial or river-dominated delta. And it's one of the few. This is one of the world's biggest, best examples of a situation where the river overwhelms the ability in its deposition of sediment. It overwhelms the ability of the sea to sweep away that deposition. In most other situations, the river or stream dumps the sediment in, but coastal tides and currents sweep it away.
Okay.
And so that many deltas don't really extend far out into the sea. In our case, the Mississippi is so huge, and its sediment volume is so enormous, and the Gulf of Mexico is relatively placid. We don't have those very strong currents and tides the way you see off in Newfoundland and the North Sea.
Sure.
And so the river wins the battle. And for this reason, I'm pointing over to these these maps that I have on the wall here. Southern Louisiana protrudes and prograades into the Gulf of Mexico. That's what a river-dominated delta means. So what this means for human habitation is that here we have a particularly fluid and dynamic piece of geography here. We humans evolved in hard earth continental environments. And so we're not that well adapted to this sort of fluidity. So what did we do upon arriving here is to seek to impose rigidity on that fluidity. This society and this beautiful city came out of that imposition of engineering rigidity. But what that rigidity also did was undermine the forces that created the underlying landscape. And therein lies the fundamental paradox and dilemma of New Orleans.
Sure. Well, and so, you know, you talk about in the book, so that Bienville decides to found, you know, he chooses maybe the lesser of two evils, but he chooses this site as the settlement site. And for the first couple of years, it really flounders. But they're right up against the river, again, as you point out, because it's the highest ground. And your description really lends credence to here in New Orleans, particularly people of a certain age, a little bit older than you and I perhaps, refer to when you cross Rampart Street as back of town. And if you think all the way back to the days of Bienville and before, that makes sense because those deposits were less and less. And so you were above sea level and then going down to back of town, swampland, marshland, et cetera. But I'd like to talk a little bit about, so those early days, once they create a settlement, it's pretty harsh conditions for them at first. And they come here thinking they're going to find mineral riches. And of course, it's not what they find.
Right. We have to remember that what really got the ball rolling to establish a French colonial society near the mouth of the river was the private sector. The territory is claimed by the French in 1682. It takes 17 years before the king finally acts on that and dispatches two French Canadians, the Lemoyne brothers, Iberville and Bienville. So they start exploring around here in 1699, but the first settlements that they create, because they're so befuddled as to how to urbanize the Delta, are in places like Mobile and Biloxi. But Bienville realizes they need to be on the river, and what serves as an impetus to finally make a move on this is the surrender of the colony by a businessman by the name of Antoine Crozat, who was granted a monopoly to develop as a private investor to develop Louisiana back in 1712. And he was completely frustrated. He didn't find gold and silver. The tobacco didn't grow well, and he couldn't establish trade ties with the Spanish. So he gave up in 1717 at precisely the time that this recklessly brilliant, flamboyant Scottish businessman, too smart for his own good, sure, one of those types, has an idea. His name is John Law, and he's hobnobbing around the royal palaces of Europe, explaining his theories on what today we would call monetary policy, the use of paper money to represent gold deposits. And so France was in debt at this time. Louis XIV had recently died, and all the spending sprees on palaces and whatnot had put France in debt. And so the monarchy at this time was represented by Philippe, the Duke of Orleans, because Louis XV was all of 5 years old at that time. And so Law had these almost too perfect plan whereby he would take on Crozat's Louisiana and create this this tobacco colony that would supplant the English growing tobacco in the Chesapeake, the enemy. Here we are, French sending money to the enemy for the best tobacco in the world, and why can't we just grow it in, sure, Louisiana? And so investors would, immigrants would come. It would form a basis for defending Louisiana against both the Spanish and the English. And the wealth would pay off the debts and enrich both the monarchy as well as John Law. And so he formed the Company of the West, and they got this charter for 25 years to bring in both immigrants, both forced immigrants as well as, mm-hmm, recruited immigrants as well as slaves. So slavery was baked into the charter. And a very specific day, September 9th, probably the 9th, it's a little obscure in the ledger, September 9th of 1717, is written in the company's ledger, resolved to establish a city to be called Nouvelle Orleans, to be located, and I'm paraphrasing, but to be located such that there is that rear alternative access to the Mississippi River. So that's when New Orleans got its name, as well as some directive of where it should be located. It takes a couple of months for that message to get across the Atlantic. So that would get us to November, and a few more months for Bienville to assemble his men and ships and supplies. And sometime between mid-March and mid-April, he arrives to what is now roughly where Jack's Brewery is today. The river, mm-hmm, has since shifted. Mm-hmm. And at an undocumented date, they hold a little ceremony, as recorded by one of the people who was there. They kind of symbolically cut the first cane brake, and work actually begins on the settlement, clearing of vegetation. So this is early spring 1718, and for that reason, we mark 1718 as the birth year of New Orleans, and 2018 as a tricentennial. In my view, the formation of New Orleans really fits into kind of a five-year window, mm-hmm, with inflection points from 1717 to about 1722 or so. And one of those inflection points was that moment where they cut the vegetation.
Sure.
That five-year period can be fit within a 40-year period from 1682 to 1722. So, you know, we tend to think of when we want anniversaries and birthdays, we humanize cities like they were born, like babies are born.
Right.
But they're improvised projects. They have messy, sloppy, multiple beginnings,
yeah,
such as the case in New Orleans.
And again, you can find the book again at you can follow Richard on social media at Nola Campanella, but you can find all of his books at richcampanella.com. And we'll put links to all that over at the website at beyondbourbonst.com/53. But you go through that in a lot of detail in the book about it's not really one moment in time, and that those early days look very different than just a few years later. There's no grid laid out, but fairly quickly, the king's, I guess it's the surveyor, comes in and they design a plan that, you know, not surprisingly, looks like what they would have done in Europe.
Right.
But
it's a perfect grid pattern with a fortress, a Vauban-style fortress with angles around it. And it gets laid out in 1722 after a hurricane, New Orleans' first hurricane, wiped the slate clean. And I'm using that phrase cautiously because if you'll recall, a dozen years ago, many people right after Katrina, with the best of intentions, said, we've wiped the slate clean. Finally, we can correct all these mistakes. But in fact, Katrina didn't even come close to wiping the slate clean because we had 285 years of value inscribed into place that even 10 feet of salt water couldn't wash away. In 1721-22, when that hurricane hit, there was only a couple of years of value inscribed into place. Mm-hmm. So the hurricane really kind of did wipe the slate clean. And the happiest man in town was Adrien de Puget, the surveyor and engineer who helped design the street grid and was frustrated by the fact that the earliest settlers impeded his execution of said plan. He actually got in a fight with someone. He had another one shackled up and imprisoned. He got in a yelling match with a housewife. This is documented stuff. It's quite amusing. So he was delighted that the hurricane wiped away New Orleans, and he could finally lay down his perfect 90-degree angle street grid, and almost to the inch, that is the French Quarter street grid today.
Well, I'm laughing because those exact same fights and arguments happened post-Katrina.
Yeah, except we didn't shackle up. We didn't neighborhood association leaders. And
That's right.
Although there certainly were yelling matches.
That's right. So it gives them a reset, if you will. But those early days are tough. But we start with this grid that's in place today. That is the foundation of the original city of New Orleans, the French Quarter. And that sort of leads me to, I'm going to jump ahead a little because you said it, but the geography then dictates over many years and the French system of how we lay out. So you have that French Quarter, and as the city starts to succeed and people come and they develop, the French are very generous with giving out these plots of land. But they do it in a way using this French measurement system, the arpent, that's very different than most of the things that we're familiar with today.
That's right. It's known as the French long lot surveying system or the arpent system. And the way it works was, and it's not unique to Louisiana. It has roots in Mesopotamia. It was seen throughout Europe. And it was brought over by the French, and to this day, you see it throughout old French North America. Mm-hmm. You see it in the St. Lawrence Valley. You see a little bit of it in the St. Louis area, and you see it all over Louisiana. The way it works is that it recognizes every planter will need access to the river, mostly for transportation, secondarily for irrigation. And it also recognizes that the only high, dry, arable, fertile land is along the river and its bayous, and to a lesser extent, along ridgetops, mm-hmm. Which were laid down by rivers and bayous. And thus, the optimal way of subdividing it is not as a meets and bounds grid or pattern as the British might have done, or a township and range grid, which the Americans did, but rather as these elongated lots that would almost look like you could compare it to a pinched accordion, the slices in a pie, or the skeleton of a sinuous snake. So elongated lots. 2 to 4 arpents. Arpent is 192 feet, roughly like an acre. 2 to 4, sometimes 8 to 10 arpents frontage along the river, going back usually to 40 arpents or 60 arpents deep. And so if you look at the street grid of the present-day New Orleans metropolitan area, its morphology is a dead ringer for that 300-year-old French cadastral system, almost again down to the inch. I could call out some names. I think many folks familiar with New Orleans will recognize them. Think Common Street, mm-hmm. Felicity Street, Upper Line, Lower Line, Joseph, Valmont. And each one of them are old plantation lines. And if you go to them today, you'll notice that the streets on the upper and lower sides of them don't quite perfectly align with each other.
Right.
Felicity Street, for example, has like a 14-degree angle. When you go down St. Charles and you cross Felicity, it's offset by the other half of St. Charles by a 14-degree angle. And so the way that formed was that each of these plantation owners individually made their urbanization decisions without any sort of coordination. It was their land. So some of them would realize, hey, you know what? We could sell off this land, make more money in urban real estate. They would hire a surveyor and lay out a street grid, but the surveyor could only do so within the confines of that long lot plantation. Mm-hmm. Their neighbor would continue in agriculture. Meanwhile, two neighbors down, they were subdividing. And so because these surveyors were laying out their grids at different times and not coordinated with each other, the streets, as they've eventually fused together, did so imperfectly. And so you could see it to this day.
Yeah, and it was fascinating. Again, here at Beyond Bourbon Street, I try to bring guests on that can help listeners sort of observe things even today that's a tie to the past and that they might not think of. And one of the things that really struck me in your book was that idea that, let's go along St. Charles because it's the easiest and maybe well known. Every time it pivots a little bit, you're at an inflection point of the back end or the side of
the sides.
One
right.
plantation.
That's right.
Moving to another.
That's exactly right. The only exceptions are the few cases where adjacent plantations were all bought out together.
Sure.
In which case, the planner was delighted to be able to erase and ignore
right.
those meaningless property lines. And the best example of that is what we now call the Lower Garden District, which was subdivided. And I'm speaking of not quite exactly what we now think of the Lower Garden District, but roughly from Howard Avenue up mm-hmm. to Felicity. Those were six different plantations, and they were all purchased and fused together around 1806 and laid out by 1810. And Bartholomew Lafon came up with the street plan there. And it includes Coliseum Square, Lee Circle, and the Nine Muses. He's the right. one who came up with all those Greek mm-hmm. names. That's the one area where you do not see the old plantation lines, again, because he was able to simply erase them. But in almost every other case, the planners were dismayed that they had to restrict their brilliant creativity to those arbitrary property lines.
It's fascinating because it gives some insight into many other places in the country that are sort of master planned. You see these just miles and miles and miles of square miles of perfect grids or perfect layout. And that's because they were working with a large canvas. But here they weren't. They were working with these little fan-shaped slices.
Right.
And the clues today, besides the bend in St. Charles Avenue, for instance, you mentioned it at the start of the podcast, is this idea of you'll go down streets that roughly follow the river, and then you'll hit a point where you have to turn and then pick back up on the street.
Right. I'll give you an example. You're coming up Britannia Street. And cruising right along, thinking that you outsmarted all those folks in that traffic jam on St. Charles. And then you come to this dead T at the Joseph intersection. And you have to stop, and you got to turn, you got to make a left about 20 feet down.
Right.
And, you know, it slows down your trajectory there. Valmont is an old plantation line. On one side, I think it was a LeBreton plantation, was developed in 1832. On the other side, which I think was Rickerville, was like 1849. So in some cases, it just appeared that the engineers and surveyors just happened to offset each other. It was probably an accident.
Sure.
In other cases, like Britannia at Joseph, if I said Valmont earlier, I meant Joseph, that it was intentional. There's no question it was intentional. And so it's hard to get in their heads, but what they might have been thinking of is that they wanted more parcels to have kind of a prominent perch, have a see and be seen perch.
Sure.
Because many of these uptown areas were developed were pretty opulent townhouses. And so if you could be seen and your property could be showcased, that would bring more value to it.
Well, and that's interesting in the context of as the city largely kind of expanded uptown, you had the Garden District, again, this sort of almost master plan because they were able to get several plantations and lay it out mm-hmm. and the opulence mm-hmm. that as you come uptown looking to sort of replicate that. You also mentioned in the book that as you get further away from the river and it widens up, it provides opportunities for the boulevards or the bigger streets. And you see that in almost every slice once you sort of unlock that key through
right.
through your book.
Right.
You can really see those clues that most of what were each of the plantations, and you go into it in detail in the book, those areas of uptown now will have an opulent street, a bigger street.
Grand Avenue.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And in every single case, the Grand Avenue perpendicular to the river went down the middle of the plantation. Jackson, Louisiana, Napoleon, State, Nashville, Broadway, Carrollton. Because, you know, the surveyors, just like today, they tend to be symmetrically inclined. And so if you have this kind of isosceles triangle and your task is to create a street grid, there's an instinct to put the Grand Avenue down the middle, have smaller blocks on either side. But then you have a spatial dilemma, if you will. How do you squeeze a 90-degree grid in an isosceles triangle? And so different surveyors came up with different techniques. Sometimes they created slight trapezoids. Sometimes they kept the squares, but then cut off certain angles of them. In other cases, they ended up creating these very elongated, slender kind of interstitial spaces. And we have them all around town today. And, you know, what do you do with them? Some of them are too narrow for a house or something. So some of them were used for markets. Others are used for schools. And some of them are just little green spaces to this day. They're little tiny triangles.
Well, that was fascinating to me because I've always wondered as you're wandering uptown, for whatever reason, at Mardi Gras a lot of times, you're parking, you're walking to St. Charles Avenue and you're dragging the parade ladder or whatever, and you find just these little snippets. Pocket park is almost too big a description.
Yep.
Might have a little fountain, a couple benches, but a little bit of green space.
Yep.
And they're almost always in a wedge with the point closest to the river.
Yeah. And where does a wedge come from? It comes from overlaying a bunch of squares on a bunch of triangles.
And you have some terrific maps in the book, again, Bienville's Dilemma, that lays that out where you can really see it. And I would encourage you, whether you're here or you're going to visit again, to take a look at that and really be attuned. And then as you wander down Magazine Street or you're riding the St. Charles streetcar, you'll have several aha moments where you go, I see that now. I see what Richard was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's what we try to do. I really like that it overlays sort of your thoughts and enjoyment of New Orleans with this historical idea through geography.
Yeah, well, the subtitle is a historical geography of New Orleans. And historical geography is challenging to write about because you have phenomena moving in multiple directions through the dimension of time. So the pure historian can always organize a book. You could always resort to pure chronology. It's linear, right? Now you have multiple things going on, but one year comes after another. When you're writing about geography, you have the X dimension, the Y dimension, the Z dimension, latitude, longitude, and elevation. Then the phenomena, various phenomena playing out. You have the river jumping all over the place. You have the people. You have levees going up. You have urbanization. You have different sort of settlement patterns. And all of this is through the linear dimension of time. So how do you organize this? And so I've grappled with this all my career, and I've taken various strategies. And the one that I took for Bienville's Dilemma that seemed to work well was instead of organizing it along a purely chronological line, I organized it by the various actions and agents that were occasioned upon this region. So the first set of articles and essays and chapters is on forming the landscape, settling the landscape, populating the landscape, urbanizing the landscape, manipulating the landscape, etc. And that allowed me a framework to fit into these complicated, you know, intermeshing stories, to fill in the gaps, because gaps are left in this, gaps in like political arena and things like that. I have a pretty extensive timeline in the front of the book that does use linear chronology. It's a timeline. And so between the timeline and then the geographical forces, which form the main part of the book, I tried to kind of get the best of both worlds.
Well, and as I took the book off the shelf to read it, not having opened it, I thought that same thing. How are you going to, and we've talked about that before, how do you arrange so many of your books and your lessons and your writings and your speaking engagements about that dilemma? And I thought that the timeline really helps because it gives you at least a sort of formation, if you will, a foundation against which you set these various things that don't always, again, jive with the time. When you said that, it reminded me, you have a fascinating article in there about batchers and the offset, that when a river, particularly here, you see it in Louisiana and in New Orleans, as the river forms these bends, if it builds up land on one side, then there's an offset.
That's right.
I don't remember what the offset to batchers were, but that was phenomenal.
It scours. In our case here, And of course, the deltaic river is always shifting in one direction or another. And so almost exactly 200 years ago, right after Louisiana Purchase, it shifted to scour out the banks on the Algiers side and run faster over there. Whereas over on the St. Mary side, which is the present-day Warehouse District, CBD, it started to run slack. Slow-moving water loses its kinetic energy and dumps out its sediment load. And so the talk of the town in 1805, 1807 New Orleans was this beach forming right off of Chapatula Street and off the Upper French Quarter even, and this beach would keep growing. And so it formed this amazing kind of geography that occasioned this fascinating kind of, shall I call it, an ethno-legal battle between, on the one side, the older Franco-Hispanic Creole population with its Roman law sensibilities, civil law, versus the incoming Anglo-American population, which brought with it English common law. And to the Creoles, this beach was public domain. It belonged to everyone. To the Americans, it was private property that belonged to the lucky plantation or landowner who owned adjacently. And so the Batcher case took like a half a century to play out. To this day, Batcher law is very complex and contradictory in Louisiana. But the way this particular one played out was essentially the Creole side won, and that's why the warehouse, but that's why we have the Warehouse District, and that's why it's part of the cityscape today.
Yeah, it was a fascinating article about that. And you mentioned, I was surprised a little bit to see that you dove into the discussion of Creole, and you just mentioned
it. Well, anyone writing about Louisiana history has an obligation to go there.
Yeah, and it's not, as you describe in the book, people may be visiting think, well, I get asked all the time, what's the difference between Cajun and Creole? And I say that's an almost unanswerable question because there's so many facets of it. But in your book, you talk about Creole and it's how you can see it in terms of geography and the fact that Creole didn't necessarily mean what we think of as Creole today or as how people identify themselves as Creole.
Creole is noun, it's adjective. It went through roughly about four or five shifts in definition over the course of, the original European colonization of the Caribbean up until modern times. I don't know if we necessarily need to go into that here, but
sure.
But my interest in the relationship between Creole and geography, I spend a lot of time thinking about residential settlement patterns,
mm-hmm.
where people live, in what patterns, in ethnic, the formation of ethnic enclaves, ethnic associations with certain neighborhoods, racial and class and caste patterns and how they play out in neighborhood geography. And so throughout the full, at least over 200 years, the average New Orleanian had a notion that there were certain parts of the city that were Creole and mm-hmm. other parts that were not. And so this usually implied in the 19th century a more deeply rooted, locally born population that was almost always French-speaking, that was usually Catholic, but they were yoked together by nativity, by being mm-hmm. from here with roots traceable to the colonial era. So who wasn't Creole? Who was not Creole was the incoming English-speaking Anglo-American populations. It was the incoming immigrants from Germany, from Ireland, from Spain and Italy and Latin America. They were not Creole. And it was not other so-called foreign French who were not from here. And so I'm speaking of immigrants directly from mm-hmm. France as well as from Saint-Domingue, who were, now they had commonalities of
sure.
language and faith, but there were sometimes uneasy alliances between the foreign French and the local Creole French. Foreign French tended to look down on the local Creoles as provincial country cousins.
Mm.
And whereas the Americans wanted to establish political alliances with the uptown Irish and German in order to create a numerical majority and start
sure.
winning elections.
Sure.
And all of this had geography to it, that they had residential settlement patterns that were ethnically and racially revealing.
Yeah, well, and it made me think back to our earlier conversation. So again, Richard's been on the show. This is the third time. We did an episode about how Bourbon Street happened and also an episode about Lincoln's visits to New Orleans. But in the discussion about Bourbon Street, we talked quite a bit about how even within the relatively small confines of the French Quarter, you can see geographic patterns of culture and identity. And we talked about the Americans sort of being on the uptown side and the immigrants or Creoles originally, but then various immigrants. They used to call the other side of it Little Palermo.
Little Palermo, that's
and
right.
And you still see, right. You can still, if you're looking for those clues, you can see them even today.
Yes.
Yeah, I think about Central Grocery.
Yep.
Every time I walk past Central Grocery or go in, who's kidding who, for a muffalata on Decatur, you're on that downtown side relative to Jackson Square and then the French Market behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you have several articles that not only talk about the Creole population, but in general, ethnicities sort of dividing along geographic lines, usually based on the value of the land available at the time that group
came. It was a number of factors. We had a Chinatown. Everyone knew where the Jewish neighborhood was. It usually meant Dryad Street, where Orthodox Jews settled, whereas the older Reform population was more uptown, and the German Ashkenazic predecessors of that Reform community were originally in the Lafayette, Jackson Avenue, Chapatoulas area. We had a Greek enclave on North Dershowitz Street. There was a Little Saxony. We still use the term Irish Channel now.
Yeah.
And of course, sometimes we use the term French Quarter like a proper noun that we don't think about what exactly the French Quarters, right? That is an ethnic enclave. And, you know, other people at the time, 200 years ago, Americans called it the Creole Quarter, the small Q with an S at the end. You listen to many old timers, perhaps even your grandparents, they call it the Quarters, with a small Q and an S at the end, alluding to this more loose and amorphous and less kind of ceremonialized and reified and kind of codified sense of place like we have today, of certain neighborhoods having very distinct boundaries and official names. People were much more soft and fluid in, to use a metaphor we used previously, in their recognition of space, urban space and place.
Well, and it's fascinating to me as a native. So I grew up here, on my dad's side, Italian, but like many in New Orleans who say they're Italian, really their roots are in Sicily,
yeah,
Palermo.
Yeah.
My dad's mom, my paternal grandmother, excuse me, lived to be 100, and she grew up in the French Quarter.
Wow.
When
was she born?
She was born, well, she passed this year.
Wow.
So she lived to be 100, and
wow,
she was educated by the Ursulines in the French Quarter.
She's a living legacy.
She remembered that. They had a little corner shop, like a lot did. And again, you see vestiges of that, again, the Central Grocery or the French Market, particularly maybe 20, 30 years ago.
She was born in 1917.
Yeah.
You know, as she walked around and as a little girl, she would have heard English, she would have heard Sicilian, and she would have heard the last of the French language in the Lower Quarter into the 1920s. Yeah.
Well, and again, in the book you point out, based on several writings of people that were here hundreds of years ago, how multicultural New Orleans has always been. And it influences everything from our the way we lay out the geography to the architecture, the food. And I think to bring that forward post-Katrina, some of those arguments that were had post-Katrina, and you hear it even today about New Orleanians and not understanding tradition and culture.
Yeah, the world's weakest argument, by the
right.
way. The world's
because
weakest argument.
This city,
argument.
As much as any, has always been dependent and influenced and flourished based on that slamming together of different cultures.
And the degree to which it didn't coincided with its periods of decline.
Hmm.
There were a number of other traumas and disasters that occasioned incoming populations. Right after the Civil War, there were incoming emancipated people who moved to the city, that diversified the city. Sicilians, the reason why we have Sicilians here is that they were specifically recruited to replace emancipated slaves on plantations, and as well as Chinese. They were recruited out of Havana, of all places, where the Cubans had previously replaced enslaved communities by bringing in from Asia. And so after Katrina, when when there was an influx of Latin American populations, I saw direct parallels to what happened after previous traumas.
Yeah, and much like that. So there were, you know, we have a whole different slice on our cuisine now because of that post-Katrina.
That's right.
So
that's
the
right.
Latin influence, it's different than we had before. There mm-hmm. are, you go down Magazine Street, for instance, and I can think of three or four restaurants that didn't exist before that have that influence because there's a demand and there's a blend of people came to help us recover.
And to add another food way here, the Vietnamese was little known before Katrina, even though it was well established on the West Bank and eastern New Orleans, and has since been embraced nationwide. And so you start to see those families who used to run a lot of Chinese restaurants
right.
and had Vietnamese options, but they branded their enterprises as Chinese restaurant. That's gone now,
right.
or at least reduced. Now they're like proudly Vietnamese.
Yeah.
But how did that population get here? Once again, it was trauma. It was the trauma of war. They arrived as refugees.
In fact, that reminds me, I need to do a whole other episode on the Vietnamese population here in New Orleans.
Uh-huh.
And we're getting near the end of our time, and we could go on and on about the book. There's one other topic I'd like to hit there just briefly. And again, this could be a whole episode, but the idea of geography and race. And one of the articles that I found fascinating in your book is this idea of the white teapot.
The white teapot, one of my more infamous coinages. I look at a lot of, and I should mention, Bienville's Dilemma. I wrote this book with a bunch of new material, but also a lot of material that I drew from my previous research, 5 years in the making, in a book called Geographies of New Orleans, where I did a lot of the technical number crunching. And what Bienville's Dilemma is kind of a reader to describe that in a more essay form. But the number crunching that went into the previous book, Geographies of New Orleans, I spend a lot of time looking at historical patterns of African-American settlement from the era of enslavement, but also free people of color, into modern times, the effects of racist deed covenants, the effects of environmental nuisances and risks and relegation and discrimination. And when I was first analyzing the 2000 census, when it was first released, it was 17 years ago now, I was analyzing, because I do a lot of mapping, I was analyzing it at the block level, and you see this kind of distinct pattern that's shaped like a teapot. And the kettle of the teapot is Uptown University.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's where you have these predominantly white populations. The spout of the teapot is along the St. Charles Magazine Corridor through the Garden District, coming through the CBD and the French Quarter, and tipping out in the Marigny Bywater area. And so this teapot-shaped phenomena describes this predominantly white residential settlement area in a city that is otherwise predominantly African-American. So what I do as a geographer is I map, characterize, and try to explain spatial patterns. And so I dubbed this phenomenon the white teapot, and it's since kind of caught on, for better or worse. But I mean it as a morphological phenomena that is worthy of that impacts people's lives and is worthy of explanation. And I explain how this came into place.
It's a fascinating article. The book is full of them, but I hit on that one last night and I thought, wow. And then I stopped and realized I live in part of that white teapot.
Yeah.
And so you are drawn to places that you don't even realize. And then you become a part of that
well,
and the effects
exactly.
of it.
And, you know, I when I share with my students here, we're at Tulane University in the heart of the white teapot. And you know, I often have discussions with my students and I'll hear things like, oh, it's such a small city. I ran into my friend over in the River Bend and we were at this coffee shop and magazine. I saw another friend and we took the streetcar in the quarter and I ran into some of my sorority or fraternity friends over there. But the reason is, and these are mostly kind of middle class to upper middle class white kids, and they're circulating within a spatial area, within a geography that is more like them. and it's a city of a million people. If they went to Gentilly or Eastern New Orleans and West Bank, I could almost guarantee they're not going to run into their friend and their sorority sister. But because they're circulated, they spend like 90-something percent of their time in 5% of the city, of course they're going to run into people who are very much like them. And, you know, the same thing can be said about folks growing up in Eastern New Orleans, that they're going to be more likely to circulate in spaces that they're familiar with where folks look like them, for better or worse. And so these centuries-old patterns affect our everyday lives.
And that's what was fascinating to me, because I certainly use the very common repeated axiom in New Orleans. Right, you run into people so often. It's such a big, such a small, big town. But really, it's because we're being driven into these, we're sort of reinforcing these things, right?
Exactly.
And you see, you could go on and on, but you see people that rarely leave a very, very small subset mm-hmm. of a neighborhood. And of mm-hmm. course, so then you do know everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I enjoyed so much the book, but getting to share it with people, because it's a different lens on a city that has so many layers to it. Again, it's Bienville's Dilemma. You can find it at richcampanella.com. You can follow Richard on Twitter at Nola Campanella. And I love following you there. One, the new articles you're constantly producing, but also to see you and your family living life in New Orleans and exploring. We'll put all the links to how you can find out about all of Richard's books and social media over at beyondbourbonst.com/53. But again, Richard, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show.
You're welcome, and thank you.
All right. I always enjoy talking with Richard, and today was no exception. His lens as a geographer helps me look at the city in a completely different way. You can find the notes for today's episode over at beyondbourbonst.com/53, including the link to Richard's website, richcampanella.com, and you can also find out over there about all of his books and a whole lot more. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the show, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you and me. We're working on a couple of episodes about the plantations, plus a whole lot more. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.